few years ago on this retreat, I was doing walking meditation up on the sidewalk there next to the lawn on the north side, and I noticed a lot of bees flying back and forth in front of me, the yellow jackets. And I stopped, and they all seemed coming from one direction. I noticed they were all coming out of this one juniper bush. Still, the juniper bush is still there. And I know from experience that they nest in the ground. My little sister was out in the yard with my dad one time when he dug into one of those nests accidentally, mm-hmm. and they came swarming out, and you know, her little legs couldn't get her away fast enough, and she got stung a bunch of times. So I was concerned that the gardeners would sort of be just doing their thing and not really think about it and accidentally disturb that nest and be harmed. So I was in the dining room and happened to notice Salvador, the buildings and ground head here, come into the kitchen. So I went in and I said, "Oh, you know, heads up, there's a wasp nest or yellow jacket nest in that juniper over there." And he says, "Oh, okay, I'll take care of it. I'll kill them." And I didn't know what to say. He's in charge. He has his job. And so I just kind of stumbled out. And, you know, my initial reaction to that was confusion. But, you know, we were also doing the metta practice and things on that retreat. And I started thinking about it. I really started feeling guilty that I had caused harm to these, you know, innocent creatures that were just going about doing their job, living their lives. So I brought it up in a Q&A with John and Dennis. And John said, I mentioned guilt, and John said, "No, that's not a Buddhist virtue. What you need to do is you need to go back out to that hive and tell them you're sorry." As you probably, you may or may not know, John has a Native American background, mm-hmm. so that, you know, very consistent with the Native American practice in hunting. They'll often express it as being that the animal came to them and gave up its life. And often when they harvest plants or animals, they will, you know, ask forgiveness first. But it's also very consistent with the Buddhist practice of compassion. And that's the subject of the talk tonight, compassion. We're moving through the Brahma Viharas. Dennis gave the overview the first night. Diane talked about metta last night. And compassion, John's approach shows, is about dissolving barriers between us and the other. Specifically, the technical definition is it's metta turned towards suffering. So it's the same open, boundless friendliness, love, if you will, although as Diane pointed out, that word has its dangers. It's this boundless opening of the heart toward beings that are in a situation of suffering, including ourselves. So, the ideal, in, as we progress in this practice, would be that these qualities of the heart would be the default setting, just as it was for John. First thing he thought of was compassionate response. For me, my initial response was confusion. So we're training our mind to gradually take these on as a natural response of the heart. The Pali word for compassion is karuna, and it's sometimes rendered as a trembling or a quivering of the heart. And when you hear that, sometimes it sounds like it's weak, you know, trembling. But really what it is, I think that those words are used to convey the opposite of hard-heartedness. You know, hard-heartedness closes itself off to the experience of others, the experience of ourselves, and it allows cruelty, which happens to be the far enemy of compassion. And therefore, as Diane pointed out, the far enemy, you can also think of that as being the antidote for cruelty is compassion. Joseph Goldstein points out that empathy is the first step in compassion. So we need to be able to actually feel the suffering in another. Or for that matter, feel our own suffering before we can respond to it. But empathy goes beyond that. Empathy takes the time to really open to the suffering. Rather than just sort of, oh yeah, I see that suffering and then moving on, it actually takes the time to be with that suffering and open to it. Which is what John was urging me to do with the bees. And the potential harm that I had caused them was to actually be there with them. I spent the whole next walking period just being with that hive, with the understanding that, you know, they might be destroyed as a result of my actions. Actually open to that and to be with it. We often say in the formal practice, the meditative, concentrative practice, of these Brahma Viharas, that there's no expectation that something happens in the outside world. But of these four, compassion is the one that most often results in action. There's something about the nature of compassion and just the nature of the human heart that when we realize suffering, we want to do something about it. I have kind of a mysterious story that I've never quite figured out completely, but it does illustrate this point of this natural movement to compassion. When I was a freshman in college, I brought a bunch of friends over to Marin County, where I grew up, from the East Bay, to introduce them to a beach that I really liked there. And so it was actually sunny day, which can be unusual in the summer in Marin. So we were all laying out on the beach. I was laying down on a tile. I was actually asleep. And I've never known why, but I jumped up from that tile and I ran maybe 10, 20 yards across this beach. And this beach has a bunch of holes in it. These back from the waves, had these holes that are filled with water. And the sides are really steep, so that when you stand on the sand on one side, when you step into them, I mean, I was over my knee with one leg, the other one was still on the sand, really steep-sided. So I ran into this hole, and I reached into the dark water, couldn't see a thing, and pulled out a child. And I've never known what it was that caused me to wake up, how I knew there was something in there, because I never saw anything. There was no thrashing around or anything. I just reached in and pulled out this child. And then we walked. I said, you know, where's your family? And we walked and found this big, huge group of people. And he said this was them, and I dropped him off. Neither of us said a thing. I walked back and I went back to sleep. And when I woke up, of course, my immediate reaction was that was a dream. Yeah, but I mean, it wasn't. I was still wet. And, you know, I've never really understood that story. But when I was preparing this talk, that story came to mind, which I hadn't thought of in years. And that phrase, the quivering of the heart, came to mind. I thought, well, maybe what that was that sort of disturbance in the force field from that child, you know? I mean, the child was probably pretty terrified. Somehow caused my heart to quiver and respond. So that story is only meant to say that the human heart, when it feels the suffering of another, just wants to respond. And it does so quite instantly sometimes. So the far enemy of compassion is cruelty. And when we understand that other beings suffer just as we do, and we feel that empathy, then we're no longer capable of cruelty. We're no longer capable of harming another being, because we know that just like us, other beings suffer. We understand how that feels for them. We know how it feels for us, and we wouldn't ever wish that or certainly do that to another. Jack Kornfield talks about another far enemy. It's not one of the traditional ones, but I think it's quite insightful, and that's despair. When we think of, and I'll go into more detail about how the different Brahma-Viharas interact with each other, but when we think of compassion not balanced with equanimity, when we think of maybe the more general population definition of compassion as being just feeling another's sorrow, empathy without the balance, then you could see how that could lead to despair, because if Kuan Yin hears the cries of the world and just wallows in it, you know, imagine the despair that would come about of being able to hear and feel all the cries of the world without any kind of balanced mind. So despair is another far enemy, being overwhelmed by suffering. The near enemy is pity. So compassion is metta directed toward those who are suffering. But it is not meant in any way to indicate that those are less than us. The true understanding of compassion is to understand that we are the same as everyone else. We all suffer together. Not only other human beings, but other non-human beings, sentient beings. You know, sometimes we put down the Visuddhimagga because it was written so long after the Buddha, and it was written by someone who wasn't necessarily a Buddhist first. He was a Brahmin first, Buddhaghosa. But I found this really beautiful statement in the Visuddhimagga in their section on compassion. You know how we do the different categories of being, and each of the Brahma-Viharas does them in different order? But they include the self, they include someone that's friendly, it could be the benefactor or the best friend or whatever, but someone that we're sort of friendly toward, and then it includes the difficult person, or in this case the suffering person, you know, someone that is difficult or negative, and then the neutral person. So we have these four categories generally. I mean, sometimes there are more when they roll out, but there are four categories. And regarding compassion, the Visuddhimagga says, the meditator should break down the barrier between the four kinds of people. It's one of the purposes of practicing the Brahma Viharas. The meditator should break down the barriers between the four kinds of people. So what's that? What that is saying is that there aren't four kinds of people, right? There's just one. At sometimes, you know, and you can see it on this retreat in your own experience. Sometimes we're the joyful one. Sometimes we're suffering. Sometimes we're the neutral person. And at other times, we're the difficult person. All within our own experience, to say nothing of how we're affecting others around us. So I think that's a really beautiful statement. It also points to the fact that these Brahma Viharas are not something to be practiced in separation from the rest of our wisdom practice. You know, that's really a teaching on oneself, isn't it? You know, the meditator should break down the barriers between the four kinds of people. That's a lesson that, you know, our own experience at different times and in different moods, that's our self. You know, it shifts and it changes, and at sometimes it's pleasant, at sometimes it's unpleasant, at other times it's neutral, sometimes it's difficult. We break down the barriers to do with any of that and understand that that's just the way things are. Things come and go, people come and go, people we might think of as difficult, you know, who knows, 5 years from now they might be a benefactor, and vice versa. That's just how things are. So breaking down the barriers, these practices can really be huge and go beyond just the cultivation of the feeling. You know, we typically stress that in the formal practice, the cultivation of metta or the cultivation of compassion, bringing up that feeling in the heart. But if we continue to practice, and particularly if we practice them together and do as we're doing on this retreat, where they're completely integrated with the Vipassana practice, they have a great potential to liberate the mind in the same way that wisdom practice does. So many opportunities to practice with compassion in this setting. I don't know, those of you that have been here before may notice that the landscaping is really distressed. If you go around to the parking lot there, there's at least two of the giant pine trees, you know, 24 inches in diameter, that are down and they've been cut off and hauled away just since the last time we were here. The shrubs, you know, Dennis and I were noticing the other day looking out his window that the shrubs were just really dried up and things like that. Could be the drought, could be all the trenching they're doing, that maybe there's something wrong with their water lines, who knows. But, you know, having been in this place when it's been so immaculately cared for and thriving, it's really touches my heart to see the plants and landscaping in difficulty. And the other, just one other recommendation that I'll make for you that really touches me every time I come here is that there's a couple of plaques in the hallway when you go back toward the back interview room on the left, right after you make that turn. And it's a listing of the nuns that have lived here. And it gives their name, it gives the date that they professed, the date that they became a nun, and it gives the date that they died, and it gives their age. And, you know, to think that we're in the space that these folks occupied for decades. Many of these people were older than my father, you know, who died 13 years ago. Some of them came straight from the old country, from Italy. And their legacies are right around us. If you read you'll notice two of the elder ones that died sort of toward the end were named Cecilia. In the room where we're doing our interviews is the Cecilia room. A beautiful conference room that's upstairs in between my room and Dennis's is called the Regina room. And there's a sister Regina that actually of all of them, she's the one that has a nickname, Madre. Mm-hmm. Really beautiful. So she must have been a really special mother figure to all of them. you know, how can you not feel compassion when you've been in the rooms where these women lived? You know, and in a way, we're living the lifestyle that they lived. I mean, they're engaged in the world, as we all are when we're not on retreat. you know, they were down the hill teaching in what was at the time a girls' Catholic high school. But, you know, just to look at those names and think about the stories. So many of them died in their late 80s, even 90s. You know, there's a few that 46 years old, and I think, oh, what was her story? And then the last few died after we started having our retreats here. 2005. The last ones on the list are 2005, after we started doing our retreats here in 2004. So to feel that connection with those nuns, my understanding is that the last few of them actually moved out of this facility out of generosity to their community, because they felt that for just a few of them to be here and have this big facility wasn't an adequate use of the space. So they moved somewhere else and allowed this to be rehabbed so it could be used as a retreat center, which it is now. They moved out while they were still alive. I always find that connection to those who lived here really touching. And, you know, it just seems that they're practice of prayer, contemplation, and quiet, just as at the friend center where Sim meets in Sacramento, the quiet and the contemplation, the practice, and the prayer just sort of seeps out of the walls. You know, it's still vibrating in this building in a really beautiful way. And to step back now, Dennis did a really beautiful introduction to the integrated path of practice the other night and talked about all of the Brahma Viharas, but I'm just going to step back and emphasize a couple of points again. There's a sutta that actually explains the name Brahma Vihara, where it came from, and then it gives the specific instruction of how the Buddha explained this radiating version of the practice. You know, Diane mentioned yesterday that we do the formal Buddha Ghosas practice in the Visuddhimagga now, going through the various categories. But the original practice that the Buddha describes when he talks about himself doing it is this radiating practice where the quality is just radiated out from the heart. So let me read you that. It's not very long. And I think sometimes it's hits us in a different place when we hear the original words as they were written down. So this is the Subha Sutta, S-U-B-H-A, Subha. Subha was a Brahmin student. And often these Brahmin students would come to the Buddha in sort of a debate mode. They'd be put up to it by their teacher. And they'd come to debate him. And he would deal with them, but Subha was quite sincere. And as we know, the Buddha had a way of meeting each student where they were, where they came from. So he asked a sincere question, and the Buddha gave him a sincere answer. The Brahmin student Subha, Todaya's son, said to the Blessed One, "Master Gotama, I have heard that the ascetic Gotama knows the path to the company of Brahma." Now, Brahma was the highest of the Vedic gods, so to be in the company of Brahma would be the highest spiritual achievement in the time of the Buddha. So this is a serious question. I mean, this person is actually asking, how do I get to the culmination of the spiritual path? So there's four or five paragraphs of sort of this sort of circumlocution that they often do in the suttas. I'm going to skip that and get to the heart of the matter. The Buddha says, "I understand Brahma, and I understand the Brahma world, and I understand the way leading to the Brahma world, and I understand how one should practice to be reborn in the Brahma world." What student is the path to the company of Brahma? Here a monk dwells, pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, so above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself. He dwells pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving-kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. When the liberation of mind by loving-kindness is developed in this way, no limiting action remains there. None persists there. Just as a vigorous trumpeter could make himself heard without difficulty in the four quarters, so too, when the liberation of mind by loving kindness is developed in this way, no limiting action remains there, none persists there. This is the path to the company of Brahma. And then he goes through all four of the Brahma Viharas. You know, if the mind imbued with compassion, if the mind imbued with sympathetic joy, the mind imbued with equanimity. When the liberation of mind by equanimity is developed in this way, no limiting action remains there, none persists there. This too is the path to the company of Brahma. So back to that integrated practice, what the Buddha is really saying here is that this practice has the potential on its own to liberate the mind. So these Brahma Viharas interact with each other. As Diane said in her talk, metta forms the foundation for all of them. So metta is loving kindness or loving friendliness without boundaries. And compassion is metta expressed toward one that is suffering. Bhikkhu Anala, who's a scholar monk, contemporary, talks about another way that metta helps compassion is that metta has a wider scope than compassion. You know, compassion just looks at those who are suffering, but metta looks at everyone equally. It's said that metta is like the sun or the rain. It falls equally on all. So metta kind of gives compassion that boundless quality that it might not happen if we got too tight around the concept of someone that's suffering. By treating everyone equally as one's friend, Analayo says, it prevents looking down on those in less fortunate situations. Sympathetic joy balances the cultivation of compassion by ensuring that both positive and negative aspects of life will be taken into account. If we spend all of our time practicing only with compassion, you know, again, that far enemy of despair has the chance of creeping in because all we're concentrating in is the negative. Whereas if we're practicing sympathetic joy, then every once in a while we're actually allowing ourselves to feel joy at the joy of another, and it balances the practice of compassion. And Analio says that equanimity rounds off the cultivation of compassion by freeing it from any trace of compulsion and obsession. So what he's getting at there is that often when we do these practices, we might feel like something absolutely has to happen in the outside world, that we have to take action as a result of our compassion. Equanimity gives us the discernment to be able to determine, because we're going in with a balanced mind and we're looking at the entire situation, gives us a discernment to know whether the suffering that we're seeing even needs to be addressed, and if so, how. Joseph Goldstein, in his beautiful book, Mindfulness, discusses compassion. And he says that compassion requires both openness and equanimity. It requires learning to let things in without drowning in the difficulties and without being overcome by sorrow. It means learning to simply be with the truth of the way things are. So when we, I'll be giving a talk on equanimity in 3 nights on Thursday night, and simply being with the truth of the way things are, that's an expression of equanimity. Interestingly enough, Joseph put his discussion of compassion in the chapter on right thought. And if you recall, right thought is the second of the Noble Eightfold Path, second step, and it's often also called right intention. So Diane and Dennis both talked about this connection between intention and the Brahma-viharas. The practice of the Brahma-viharas is an expression of our intention to feel metta, our intention to connect with those that are in suffering, including ourselves. So we can see that compassion, like all of the other Brahma-viharas, is very closely connected with intention, both in the way that it's practiced and in the way that it's carried out in the outside world, if that needs to be done. Joseph tells this amazing story in this chapter that happened in New York. And the account he has is from your local paper, Diane, the New York Times. Was your local paper at one time. You were talking last night how you love local, supporting the local paper. This person was standing at a subway station as a train was coming in, and someone fell on the tracks. And he jumped down, and he got on top of the person and pressed them down as the train came through. And the train passed over both of them and just barely missed them. And both of them were okay once the train pulled out. This person's name was Wesley Autry. He was known as the subway hero, but his response when asked about this, again, this instantaneous, compassionate response, he saw someone either suffering or just about to suffer greatly, and he just took action immediately. And he said, "I don't feel like I did something spectacular. I just saw someone who needed help. I did what I felt was right." That's the kind of simplicity that we can bring to this practice. And it's inspiring. We've also talked about the integration of the Brahma-viharas with our insight meditation practice. In this same book that I read the sutta from earlier, in the Buddha's words, Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's the translator and compiler of that book, says in answer to whether the Brahma-viharas are simply a concentration practice or whether they can also be an insight practice, he says, "The concentration arisen from these meditations can also be used as a basis for cultivating the wisdom of insight, and insight culminates in liberation." So I don't think there's any question that these Brahma-viharas are both. As usual, when you try to set up a dichotomy in the Dharma, it's yes, both and. It's both the concentration practice and the wisdom practice. Anālio, in his book, Compassion and Emptiness in Early Buddhist Meditations, says, "The mental attitude engendered by the Brahma-viharas will be of considerable assistance when one has to face external disturbances. instead of resulting in the frustrating experience of wavering between being concentrated on the chosen object of meditation and having lost this object due to external sounds and other disturbances, meditation can continue smoothly. This can be achieved by making the sound or disturbance part of the practice. Compassion informs one's attitude toward the disturbance or those responsible for it. You know, back again to the buzzing of the saw the other day. And then I love this sentence. In this way, problems can become the path. Problems can become the path. So things that we thought were obstacles, you know, whether that's the buzzing of the saw outside or the rustling in the room, whether that's our own particular negative thought pattern, whether that's our own chronic pain that is a constant when we're trying to meditate, potential distraction. In this way, when compassion informs one's attitude toward the disturbance or those responsible for it, in this way, problems can become the path. So I'd like to move from the overall view of compassion to a specific form of compassion, and that is self-compassion. Now, on the surface, this self-compassion, it can sort of sound like a self-help project or a new agey kind of a thing. To dispel that notion is a quote from the Buddha in the Udana, which is one of the oldest scriptures. I visited all quarters with my mind, and pardon the Victorian poetry, but this is old-fashioned translation of it. I visited all quarters with my mind. So remember how he explained the Brahma Viharas? He did first in one quarter, then the other, then the other, then the fourth. So that's what he's doing. He's doing Brahma Vihara practice. He said, I visited all quarters with my mind, nor found I any dearer than myself. Self is likewise to every other dear. Who loves himself will never harm another. So again, this is that breaking down barriers between people. He's saying, I looked everywhere and I couldn't find anyone better than myself. And yet every other person does the same thing. They look everywhere and they can't find anyone dearer than themselves. And he's not saying that that's inappropriate. He's not saying that that's conceit. He's not saying that that's clinging to self. He's saying that's completely appropriate in the context of the Brahma Viharas. Analio puts it this way. The very fact that one is engaging in compassion makes it almost inevitable that one will be soft with oneself instead of pushing too hard. Compassion encourages a soft and allowing attitude towards oneself. You know, often at the beginning of a retreat, we exert all of this effort and we push ourselves so hard to actually arrive. Sometimes we push ourselves so hard to recreate that experience we've had on a previous retreat that was so wonderful. And what this is all urging us to do is have a little bit of self-compassion. Understand that if you're not settling in this time as quickly as you have in the past, that's just the way things are in this moment. That's just the reality of the current causes and conditions. Have some compassion with yourself. Allow yourself just to be who you are in this moment. There was this beautiful question this afternoon about turning metta towards ourselves when we're in a difficult place. And, you know, Diane explained that, well, we wait until we're in, you know, when we're doing metta practice, we wait until we are in a place where we can feel that instantaneous connection on a loving level, such as when, you know, we're a baby or we've just done a kind act for someone else. That's because this is compassion practice. Turning metta toward ourselves when we're in a difficult place is exactly the definition of compassion practice. It's self-compassion. It's actually the practice of self-compassion. And as was said by several of us this afternoon, that's exactly when we need it the most, is when we're in a difficult place. So just know that there's this quality of these practices where we learn the appropriate situation for everything. We learn the appropriate situation for doing deep concentration practice, the appropriate situation for moving out to a more generalized attention where we might be looking at the whole body or the spaciousness of the room or something. We learn when each of the Brahma Viharas is appropriate. So when we're in a difficult place, it might not be best to be using metta in that moment. It might be best to be turning to self-compassion. It's completely appropriate. So what I might suggest between now and when we do the formal practice of compassion tomorrow afternoon is look for a little moment when you might practice self-compassion. You know, it might be in a sitting when a difficult mind state arises. It might be in walking when you know, you're feeling some pain in your back. It might be in sitting practice when you can't concentrate the mind. That's bothering you. Some frustration is coming up. This word frustration always has a couple sentences after it, the word expectation, because we're not meeting the expectation that we were holding. So if we're feeling frustrated, it's because there's some expectation that's not being met. So if there's some frustration, perhaps that, you know, when you're, oh, I haven't dropped in to the level that I want, my mind isn't as concentrated as I would like, just step back and try a little bit of self-compassion. See if you can do that in that moment. If you can actually feel, first of all, recognize it as suffering, okay? We have to be able to recognize these negative mind states and these aversion to our physical pain and all of that. We need to first recognize it as suffering. Once we've done that, then the natural impulse of the heart will be to pour out metta toward that suffering. And that is compassion. So just give that a try. One of the modern proponents of self-compassion is Dr. Kristen Neff. She gives workshops at Spirit Rock and things, so she's pretty connected with the mindfulness movement. But she's the one that's really studied self-compassion and given it some clinical cred. And she says, with self-compassion, we give ourselves the same kindness and care we'd give to a good friend. So as Diane explained, metta comes from the same root as mitta, which means friend. So Kristen's making that connection here. We give ourselves the same kindness and care we'd give to a good friend. Having compassion for yourself means that you honor and accept your humanness. Things will not always go the way you want them to. You will encounter frustrations. Losses will occur. You will make mistakes, bump up against your limitations, fall short of your ideals. This is the human condition. A reality shared by all of us. Again, breaking down the barriers between us and the other. This is a reality shared by all of us. The more you open your heart to this reality, instead of constantly fighting against it, the more you will be able to feel compassion for yourself and all your fellow humans in the experience of life. And then she goes on to explain with these beautiful little short essays on her website, that it is not self-pity. You know, we've already talked about pity being the near enemy of compassion. So it's not self-pity. It's not self-indulgence. And it's not self-esteem. So I think you can pretty clearly see why it wouldn't be self-indulgence. Because self-indulgence often means we fall into these sort of mindless ways of propping ourselves up that aren't really addressing the root problem of the suffering itself. Self-esteem took me a while to get. What she's saying is that self-compassion addresses us even in our weakness, even when we're feeling poorly, even when we're failing even when we're falling down, even when we're not meeting our own expectations. Self-esteem is based on a comparison, and it's based on looking for places where we perform well and feeling good about that. So that's not self-compassion. Not that there's anything wrong with that on its own, but it's not self-compassion. I want to move into one final area, and that is the application of compassion to our engagement with the world. So as I mentioned before, compassion of all of these tends to encourage us to take action in the real world. And, in the Mahayana tradition, the Bodhisattva ideal is to, work toward the liberation of all beings with compassion. That can also result in burnout. That grandiose ambition to take on the suffering of all beings, as we've talked about before. So Mushin Patricia Ikeda, who's a teacher at East Bay Meditation Center in Oakland, wrote an article in the newest issue of Buddha Dharma magazine, and it's specifically about burnout. And she says, burnout and self-sacrifice, the paradigm for the lone hero who takes nothing for herself and gives everything to others, injure all of us who are trying to bring the Dharma to everyday life through communities of transformative well-being, where the exchange of self for other is re-envisioned as the care of self in service to the community. And then she quotes, for me, an unlikely Dharma teacher, Angela Davis. Remember her as a flaming radical of the 60s and 70s. She was teaching at Cal when I went there, and we had this huge student strike and everything about her being fired and all of that. She had this beautiful big afro and was one of the first proponents of Black is Beautiful. Angela Davis says this, and she says this today. I think our notions of what counts as radical have changed over time. Self-care and healing and attention to the body and the spiritual dimension, all of this is now a part of radical social struggles. This wasn't the case before. So one final quote, have to quote Sharon Salzberg at least once, as Diane said. Her book, Loving Kindness, The Revolutionary Art of Happiness, is a fantastic book. And it doesn't just talk about loving kindness. It goes through, has very detailed chapters on each of the Brahmaviharas and some other of these positive qualities that we're trying to cultivate in our practice. Sharon says, compassion enjoins us to respond to pain, and wisdom guides the skillfulness of the response, telling us when and how to respond. Through compassion, our lives become an expression of all that we understand and care about and value. Let's sit for a minute to let the word sink in.